thank you for joining us with the MSU Extension AgCast. Our program is here to provide you with unbiased and research-based information directly to your ears. No matter where you are in the world, MSU Extension faculty will be here to discuss and analyze current trends and issues facing the agricultural industry in Montana today. This program is being brought to you with the support of Montana State University Extension and the Western SAIR. Hello, everyone, and thank you for returning to part two of episode three. This episode featured special guests Jane Mangold, Tim Seipel, and Ben Hotman. We left off our discussion of invasive plants in Montana as we talked about some of our least favorite weeds in the state, and now stay tuned as we discuss noxious weeds and herbicide resistance.
And we're back. We're going to jump into kind of a sometimes misunderstood part of the weed world, in not so much in what qualifies, but why certain stuff doesn't, and that's noxious weeds, and just what is a noxious weed, how impactful are they, and actually for this one, Jane, I'm going to let you explain what a noxious weed is.
Okay, well thank you, Matt. So noxious weeds are those, they're non-native plants, so they're not native to Montana, and they're actually species that are designated by the State Department of Agriculture or the county, but we start at the state level. And as I said before, it's a species that's not native to Montana. They can form dense infestations, and the definition says, according to this state law, that they render land unfit for agriculture, forestry, livestock, wildlife, and other beneficial uses, or they're species that harm native plant communities. And the county Noxious Weed Act, which Ben can probably talk about a lot more than I can, says that landowners should not let these plants propagate or go to seed on their property.
So what's the difference between a noxious weed and a regulated weed? You or Ben, whoever wants to answer this one.
I'll take a shot at it and Ben can add as he sees fit. So we have 36 species on the state noxious weed list. And again, these are species that if you have them growing on your property, you should not be letting them produce seed, reproduce. The regulated plants, there's five of them on the noxious weed list. Those are species that the state is trying to kind of contain or regulate their movement within the state. Or some of those species that are on there as regulated plants are not here at all. They're aquatic species, and we're trying to keep them from coming into the state, for example, through the aquarium trade. Okay. So you're not mandated to control those species, but we are trying to keep them from moving around.
So the first one that comes to mind, cheatgrass is regulated, right? Russian olive?
Yes.
Regulated? So, I mean, as noxious weed forage inspectors, cheatgrass is on our list because we can't allow it to go out of the state. I don't even think you're supposed to let it allow go out of the county, technically. Right?
I think cheatgrass is regulated and not noxious because it's going to be too hard to manage in seed for selling seed. Like, isn't that right?
Yeah, there was a lot of debate. So when a species gets listed by getting, someone submits a petition to the State Department of Agriculture, asking a species to be added to the list, and they give reasons why it should be added. And then there's a working group that reviews those petitions, reviews the literature, what do we know about this species, where else is it growing, what are any documented impacts of the species, and they make recommendation then to the Director of Agriculture, who makes the final decision. But when cheatgrass was petitioned, there was a lot of discussion surrounding that species. And one of the points of discussion was it would be difficult for the seed growers to actually remove all cheatgrass from seed that they were producing. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of discussion surrounding Russian olive, as you can imagine, because it does have some beneficial uses. So, yeah, some of these species, that there's a lot of debate about just where they should fall on the noxious weed list. Can they be regulated through the Seed Act? And we do have some species that are regulated more through the Seed Act, like Palmer amaranth.
We have plenty of native plants that could be considered pretty invasive. And they can never end up on this list, correct? Because they're native?
We will not list a native species as the law stands right now.
So the one that I always got in the weed office in Yellowstone was, you know, stuff like, why isn't kochia on the noxious weed list? I mean, is there any rhyme or reason behind that? Is it just because it's so prolific it could never actually even be controlled? Or
mostly, I think that's the answer, right? There, kochia is in every county, along every roadside, and in a lot of crop fields. We try our best to control kochia and keep it out of crop fields, not always along certain disturbed areas or right-of-ways or things like that, but it's a species that we actively manage, but it's a weed of agricultural fields, and most of the noxious weeds on the list tend to be species that are invasive in rangelands or have impacts on rangelands if you go through the list.
Yeah, I think we think about species in terms of where do they primarily grow, and a species like kochia is primarily growing in very disturbed systems. You know, crop fields are very disturbed systems.
Roadsides.
When you think about species that are on the noxious weed list, I think many of them fall more within that category of being invasive. They can move and spread without any help from us.
Disturbance is not an equanimity.
Yeah, it helps, and maybe sure. it's a foothold by which a plant arrives and gets established, but then it can tend to move even in areas that to our eyes don't look disturbed.
That's true. I've seen perfectly healthy rangeland with leafy spurge in it, but you're never going to see perfectly healthy rangeland with kochia. So that's a pretty valid point. We're going to segue from that into another segue, so we're going to segue squared. Kochia, of course, is the highest has the most herbicide resistance in the state, correct? I think it is resistant to the most chemistries and cross chemistries.
Yes, that and wild oak, but wild, I would say kochia is probably slightly more problematic across the entire state.
Okay.
And kochia is also resistant to ALS herbicides, or our group 2 herbicides, which we have really relied on to manage weeds in our small grain cereal cropping systems. That's been our staple for a long time, these group 2 herbicides. So Gleam, I can name the names. Yeah. I have to think of the trade names.
Sulfonylureas.
Exactly, our SU herbicides. And so that is really what stands out the most. And now we have glyphosate-resistant kochia as well, so resistance to Roundup, which is, you know, between group 2 herbicides, our ALS herbicides, and glyphosate, which being a group 9, those are really some of the most common herbicides that we use. So kochia becomes really problematic in that sense because it takes away tools that we can use.
Well, and those sulfonylureas, I mean, they're methylfuron, chlorosulfuron, they're all out there, and not just used in cropland, but also in regulatory weed control. So stuff Ben sprays on roadsides. I mean, there's a lot of kochia on the roadside, and those two chemistries are pretty popular in road mixes. So it's a pretty broad concern. a lot of you will recognize Fionnuria herbicides because they control all of our mustard family weeds. So pretty much anybody in cropland is going to be experienced with it. So like Tim says, that's a huge setback. But to segue from that, before I make my other segue, so segue, this is the square of the segue, is Palmer amaranth. Palmer amaranth is a pretty hot topic amongst extension right now. It is probably the most herbicide-resistant weed in the nation. I think it's up, has like 24 resistances and multiple modes of action resistances and the whole gamut. So we are more or less pretty well scared to death of this plant getting in Montana. And because of that, I would like Jane and Tim to take a moment and talk about the Palmer Amaranth Task Force.
So Palmer amaranth, let's first step back. It's a pigweed. It is a dioecious pigweed, like hemp, so it means it's a male and a female plant. They cross, so there's a lot of genetic outcrossing whenever you make seed. So it's a really genetically diverse plant. It makes a whole lot of seed. It has become incredibly problematic in the Mid-South, of the United States and into the Midwest. Yeah. Resistance to five modes of action in a single genotype. So you're taking out huge amounts of tools that you could possibly use. Weed Science Society of America in 2016, most problematic weed in the United States. Luckily, we don't have it in Montana. Not yet. It's in North Dakota, South Dakota. It's been reported in Wyoming. And there's just a few states left that don't have it. And so if this weed moves into Montana and it establishes itself and becomes problematic in our pulses or in our small grains, that's going to be a really hard thing for us to manage. And so we have the Palmer Amaranth Task Force in the state, and it's a mix of agents, extension, representatives from the Department of Montana, Department of Ag, NRCS, and really what we're trying to do is prevent its establishment, and then if it does become established, identify it, early detection, and rapid response so we don't have it spread out all over our cropping systems and really disrupt things. It's vectors while we're talking about it. We have to think, it's coming from the Midwest. Like, with the COVID pandemic, I feel like people have been talking about vectors and infection and movement. And invasive species, this is our wheelhouse. We talk about propagule pressure, movement of seeds, all these sorts of different things like that. And it really is sort of, it goes across both ways. Really thinking of managing invasive species is sort of like epidemiology, right? We have to understand how it moves in, where it goes, what happens. And so with Palmer amaranth, we have to think about, is it coming in contaminated seed mixes? Well, recently the Montana Department of Ag put it under regulated plants under the Seed Act. So that's good. We have to think about possibly in North Dakota last year, it showed up in millet fields. So we have to think about, okay, that's one of the places we need to think about looking at is in our forage and our millet fields, especially to make sure it doesn't establish. And then maybe with custom combines that are coming from the south and east of us, Kansas, Texas, those directions are coming in our direction. We have to think about equipment that might have seed stuck in it. You know, it is really hard to clean a combine, and I think everyone knows that. And so we have to think about those are our vectors, and we have to think about where to look, because we can't look everywhere and we can't test everything. So we'll have some more fact sheets coming out on how to identify the species. It's really in the seedling stage, it's pretty hard to identify. So what I've been saying is, if you have a pigweed, you don't recognize a funny pigweed, it's not red root pigweed, it's not our little tumble pigweed that shows up, then contact MSU Extension or your CCA and get it identified, I think, in that context.
Yeah, just to kind of give you guys a visualization, so not 100% sure where you're sitting right now, but I can pretty much guarantee that you either have a can of soda or a coffee cup close to you. Grab it. That diameter is about the same of the base of the stem of a Pomeranian.
It could be 10 feet tall.
And 10. So we're not just talking about something that we can combine over the top of. This stuff doesn't even go through the combine. Not even something you can tackle with corn headers. So just keep that visualization in your head a little bit. So here's that second segue. Herbicide resistance. Boy, what a fun topic. It is probably, in my opinion, the most detrimental thing to our cropping industry right now. Just on a production scale and on an economic scale. And I say that for a couple of different reasons. Most of it has to do with the cost of chemical. And if you are spraying something that is expensive and trying to control something that spray is not going to work on, you have just wasted quite a bit of money. Tim, would you start us off with herbicide resistance?
So herbicide resistance is the ability of a plant to not be killed by herbicide when it had previously been killed by herbicide. So it's an evolution or selection. It's a change in that plant. And it happens in a whole lot of different ways. So I like to think of the Tao Te Ching, actually. And if you ever read the Tao Te Ching, you read about water in there. And water is, and what it says is, water is soft and fluid and yielding, but always gets where it's going. I think any roofer would say that too. And so in that context, what I mean is you have kochia on the landscape, and we try to kill it, and we try to kill it, and we try to kill it. And we come at it with the same tool quite often. Let's use glyphosate in this yep. context. So that plant is experiencing a really hard, hard selection pressure. It's a rock that's trying to crush the kochia. And so what does kochia do? It's like the water. It kind of melds and changes and adapts to that continuous pressure that we get, that we place on it. And pretty soon, that kochia has got where it's wanted to go, and it is now resistant to that herbicide. It's because we have placed a consistent selection pressure on it over and over, the same selection pressure. So the plant changes and adapts. So kochia actually adapts in a number of ways. One, if you come at it with the same glyphosate all the time, it turns up its gene expression and makes way more copies of the enzyme you're trying to target, and you can't put enough glyphosate on there to kill the plant. For group two herbicides, we come at it with the same selection pressure of, let's say, the old Glean, chlorosulfuron, and we apply that same selection pressure. It changes one simple mutation in its DNA, and then that plant becomes resistant to those group 2 herbicides. So it figures out how to get around us, and it really is an evolutionary selection pressure. If I'm going to breed for disease resistance, in wheat, for example, what do? We infect that wheat with a disease, and then we go select for the ones that survive. Well, by applying herbicides in the field, we're putting that same selection pressure on that weed, and we're selecting for the ones that are going to survive. So that's kind of the big picture of how herbicide resistance yeah. happens in Montana.
That was a great analogy with the water thing.
Isn't it, Tim? The more effective a herbicide is, it has better, higher selection pressure, so you actually speed up the resistance building process.
Yeah, it's kind of a counterintuitive kind of thing, right?
Tries harder to survive.
It tries harder to survive. And the more we do one consistent selection pressure, the more opportunities those plants have to hit that mutation, right? Or to get it through there.
And not just that, the other issue we kind of run into is not only are we you know, putting that selection pressure on, right? Not only are we that amount of water making it move, but it's also the efficiency in which we do it. So, I mean, misapplication also greatly contributes to it,
yeah,
right? Especially in the area of glyphosate, you know, when you want to talk about 4-pound and 6-pound glyphosate. If you misapply it, then you are not putting on enough chemical to kill the plant.
And you're almost training kochia.
Yeah.
And actually, the Tao Te Ching example that I came up with was an article I read about Bruce Lee, because Bruce Lee was trying to do karate and kung fu, and he went out and he was getting beat and beat and beat. And he went out and he started smacking the water in the boat one day, and he was like, he figured it out. You have to yield in some ways, and so that's one of the ways that kochia, it says it's being trained. If you come at it with a big plant, it says, well, you know, you hit me with 4 pounds this time, and I'm turning up my gene expression, and then when you come back with 6 pounds, it's a little more trained and a little more trained, and pretty soon, 32 ounces of glyphosate
is not enough
anymore.
And I think, you know, there's one big message to tell with herbicide resistance, and that's if you are going to use herbicides, please follow the label and please use the correct tank mixes and the correct rates, because trying to save yourself a dollar on cutting your rates a little bit, I mean, those numbers are there for a pretty good reason. I know a lot of folks, you know, it's just a lot of words and lawyers wrote it or something like that, but I mean, that there is scientific cause behind why they say 24 ounces an acre or 32 ounces an acre. So it's the kind of thing that's important to follow. The big impact, of course, is in cropland, but I mean, there's also, you know, starting to impact range production as well. Cheatgrass just developed a resistance, right?
We've seen that in crop systems. I don't believe it's been documented in rangeland systems. The only two species I'm aware of that are more rangeland weeds are yellow star thistle. There's been herbicide resistance documented in that species. And about, I think, 3 years ago, there was a population of, or biotype of spotted knapweed in British Columbia that was reported to be herbicide resistant to one mold of action.
One mold of action. Okay.
This year in eastern Washington and some of the southeastern Washington counties, I know Whitman County in eastern Washington is one of them, they have documented glyphosate resistance in cheatgrass, which is a scary proposition.
Why would you say that out loud?
Because we have to recognize that this is something that is a very distinct possibility in the future.
That is the most horrifying thing I could possibly ever consider, glyphosate-resistant cheatgrass. But so the big thing is, you know, if we have herbicide resistance, how do we combat it? And I'm going to throw a term out. IPM, right?
Varied selection pressure.
Integrated pest management. So, Jane, overview for us, IPM and weeds.
Well, I'll give it a quick definition, and then Ben and Tim can jump in to add to it. But integrated weed management is using a combination of tools to manage a species. And I think one aspect of integrated pest management that sometimes gets overlooked in weed management relative to insect pest control is that the importance of threshold. So I think we've mentioned already that, you know, we're never going to get rid of all the weeds. And what we're really trying to do when we manage them is combine those tools to keep the weeds at a level that is not interfering with our management. So we're staying below a threshold at which we have either economic or ecological impacts from the weed. Did I miss anything, Tim or Ben?
I would just add the other parts of IPM that are probably skipped steps more so are monitoring and identification. the most people are familiar with IPM is using more than one management method. So, but monitoring is a big part of that too. And like Jane said, monitoring would lead you into the threshold thing as well.
Yeah, for sure. You need to know what's growing, where it's growing, and what it is.
Yeah, I think varied selection, from an evolutionary standpoint, which herbicide resistance is very much selection, it's evolution, it's changing the genome. And so when we think about it in croplands, the most important thing is to think about how do we vary selection pressure so that you're not trying to just use one tool that you hammer away at the same tool over and over, but you come at it in different ways and you integrate multiple different methods of weed control.
Well, and Tim, you and I have had the conversation multiple times. We are not going to find an answer to herbicide resistance with more herbicide.
Yeah.
That's not the tool we're going to be able to use. And there's a lot of reasons behind that. It's the answer is not going to be found in a jug. I mean, the answer is going to be found in an integrated approach of mechanical, cultural, biological understanding. You know, is one plant going to ruin everything, or can we do is that within our threshold? Can we survive with that? So, kind of taking that around, Ben, I'm going to start with you. And I know you were super happy I was going to ask you this question, but since you manage a lot of the noxious weeds on public lands and roadsides in Granite County, how do you utilize IPM?
Roadsides is a tough one to practice really good IPM for, like, the varied selection that Tim was talking about. Most county weed programs for roadsides is to send out the spray truck and spray the roadsides. The one thing that can be useful IPM method for roadside IPM is definitely the monitoring and GPS, so you can at least track your progress if you're effectively controlling the weeds with what you're currently doing. That's one step that you can do quite easily with IPM on roadsides. You have a very limited area and you see it every day when you drive it. So it's easy to track and monitor your progress. The other things that you can implement for roadside IPM, you have our chemicals is a tool. We have cultural methods. We have mechanical, biological. Is that all of them?
Yeah.
So you can implement some mechanical. You can do some mowing, and that can be useful as far as controlling seed production for some weeds. Mowing can help. You can probably integrate some biological control on roadsides as well, especially if you partner with the landowner that's over the fence line, because probably if there's weeds encroaching the roadside, they're either coming from the actual road itself, or they're coming across the fence from the neighbor. So if the patch is big enough, you could probably work with that landowner. You can get a big enough area of weeds where your biologicals could be effective on roadsides. And then I was thinking of, like, the public lands where we see a lot of the noxious weeds pop up are access points, heavily trafficked areas. So fishing access, parking lots, and probably trailheads, where you're getting a lot of traffic, where the weeds are easily moved around. And so once again, those are small areas that are easier to monitor than a big pasture. You could implement some mechanical there as well, in targeted with mowing and even hand pulling, depending on what the plants that are growing there are. You know, if you just have a little bit of hound's tongue at a trailhead, or a little bit of hound's tongue in a parking lot, it might be pretty easy to go out there, even with a shovel or something like that. If, you know, it's a limited number of plants and it's easy to pull, that can work. And then you always have your chemical control also. But yeah, there's more options than you first think when you're talking about IPM on roadsides and things like that.
Well, and even one thing that we kind of found, especially on like new construction, putting in culverts on stuff, was species selection about what you're replanting. Careful consideration about that kind of stuff, because there are species out there, they may not be the best forage species, but reclamation wise they can really do the trick about ensuring that you don't have anything coming into that disturbed area.
Definitely big part of that is recommending the right seed mix, where you have stuff that's going to establish quick to outcompete weeds and hold the soil down and minimize the exposure of the bare ground to weeds. And some people get in the trap of they need to have 20 different species in a seeding mix or something like that, but the reality is you'll have stuff that'll establish very quickly what you want, and then you want, you know, when you're revegetating, to have layers of establishment that would come after that and be able to outcompete the weeds over a long period of time. Because if you have 20 different species, some of those weaker ones, they might appear for a year or two, but eventually your other more competitive species, they'll disappear over time. So it's not the most worthwhile expenditure to have a lot of different species necessarily. Mm-hmm.
For sure. Jane, rangeland, IPM.
Yeah, well, I think on rangeland, really, IPM is your only option. You're talking about managing weeds on pretty large landscapes that don't have perhaps the same economic return that you would have in a cropping system, where you might be able to invest in a good herbicide and see that response in yield. So a lot, I feel like, you know, herbicides are definitely the most widely used tool for managing on rangeland and wildlands, but I think there's also a lot of managers that are looking at good grazing management. If livestock grazing is part of the system, that's one of the first things to begin with. But biological control, so using insects that are specific to the weed that you're trying to control, that's a good option for hard to reach, inaccessible land, like a lot of our range and wildlands are. And then kind of on the flip side of good grazing management, you also have targeted grazing, where we're actually using livestock to eat a weed, and making sure you're doing that at the right time. People are also interested in implementing revegetation. Ben talked about that a little bit, but trying to get something established again that can compete with the weed. So I feel like integrated weed management is arguably more of a requirement on range and wildlands than it might be elsewhere, just because a lot of that land is inaccessible to equipment where you could get in and easily spray, and the economic return is not as great.
Kind of one more thing, that prevention. I think prevention is one of the best options that we have, and that requires really thinking about vectors, where seeds go, where all these things happen. And because prevention means we don't have to go spend a lot of time, if we're successful, digging the thick taproot of hound's tongue out of the ground and those sorts of things like that.
Yeah, and I totally spaced this. I even wrote it in my notes and just skipped over it. But we, in Blaine County, we ended up getting one of those vehicle washing stations.
Oh, yeah.
It was broke down. The motor or pump or something wasn't working, so they gave it to us for free. And the goal was to get that running. And I think they did get it running, but I moved counties before it was operational. But the goal was to have it in a spot where easy access for people who hunt and fish and stuff like that will be able to drive in and use it and wash all the seed off and things like that. And I don't think people realize how easily weeds attach to vehicles. But I think we have a Mont Guide or something that has spotted knapweed, and they drove a vehicle through spotted knapweed and looked to see how many seeds were attached after driving 10 miles. And it was shocking how many knapweed seeds were still on that vehicle.
Well, yeah. And even just thinking of, I mean, there's a lot of plants out there where you would never even see the seeds with your naked eye. You know. Tim, your turn. IPM, cropland. What you got?
IPM in cropland, vary your selection pressure. That's what I say. And that comes through maybe diverse rotations. We have research now that we're just finishing up in the peer review process that shows if you have a spring planted crop versus a winter planted crop, then those weed communities actually vary quite a lot. So if you're planting something, for example, winter wheat, and this is something that I bring up a lot, and actually most producers get this question when I ask them. I say, what's the hardest thing about managing cheatgrass in winter wheat? And they all go, it's a winter annual. And so you have a wheat, winter wheat and cheatgrass are both going to emerge at the same time. Well, if I switch up my crop rotation and I have a spring planted crop, that gives me the opportunity before I plant that spring planted crop to come in and apply a herbicide, or if I'm organic, put some sort of tillage in there. So you're selecting it in different times. And so you have to think about, we're never going to get rid of weeds, but we can select what weeds might be in those different systems. And so I think one of the things is, and that goes to diversity and rotation. You know, maybe you don't want to plant a spring canola, but maybe you have a winter canola, and then another year you follow it up with spring durum or some spring wheat. Well, then you're managing weeds at different times of the year, and that's applying different selection pressures to those weeds. Being able to use different crops that are susceptible to different herbicides is another way to sort of vary that selection pressure. Integrated weed management means getting a good stand of crops in there. You know, if you have a good competitive crop, if you have a dense stand of barley, you're going to have fewer weeds. And if you have kind of a wimpy stand of barley, and maybe you have some older seed that was just out of the bin and, you know, it didn't germinate well. So those sorts of things. So thinking of all these different tactics and how they come together, I think that's the key to integrated weed management in crop fields.
Matt, could I say one more thing on the prevention side of things?
No. Of course you can, Jane.
Well, we're here talking about weeds today, and you know, we tend to focus on that a lot, but if you look about the noxious weed list and where those species are in the state, about 90% of the land in Montana does not have noxious weeds. So I think for those of us that think about weeds, we tend to pick them out everywhere and see them everywhere.
Oh, for sure.
But they're not. And the importance of prevention cannot be overemphasized when it comes to integrated weed management and taking care of what we have, monitoring for new plants. Either they're showing up along the highway or they're showing up in the field where the millet seed was planted. So that really can't be overemphasized.
We're going to kind of head towards the tail end here. But the one thing I've really enjoyed focusing on these episodes has been doing a little myth busting. There is a huge amount of misinformation out there. And weed control is just one of those things. But I would appreciate us breaking down some of the myths we might have heard on managing weeds, especially at home, without using herbicides. What do you prefer as your control method?
Well, I'll start, and I'm going to go, it's coming back to this discussion about dandelions a little earlier and how your lawn was so overrun, and it ties into prevention. I actually have a near dandelion-free lawn. Now, I have a little...
Humble brag much, Jane?
Well, okay, I'm just, This isn't about me. It's about some of the things that I'm talking about here. But about 10 years ago, my husband and I did a little, we added on to our house. It's a very small lot in Lozman, but we actually redid the lawn. So I started with a clean slate of no dandelions. And over the last 10 years, I actually just, when a dandelion shows up as they flower, I just go out there and pop them out of the ground with a little hand tool. So that's talking about the importance of prevention, right? I didn't let the lawn get overrun with dandelions. I started dealing with them when they showed up.
I feel personally attacked right now.
It's okay, Matt. You're just helping out the pollinators.
That's right.
They are helping with dandelions. Okay. So I don't even remember.
You're such a good sport, Jane.
Busters. But I think that that's an example of prevention, how important that is, and also that you can manage a species without herbicides, especially if it's there. It's not very abundant yet.
The one of the reasons I bring this up is I've recently at Monday it started, and for about 2 days I had 4 different questions about white top. And how to manage white top without chemical. So it just got me to thinking on how do we manage things without chemical. Ben, you're thinking really hard. Like I can.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of a myth.
Really, if we're gonna throw myths out there, there's one big one that I would, you know, on the last Scudder Lab episode, Noel and I chatted about a little bit, but we're gonna chat it about some more today, and that's gonna be vinegar. We hear a lot about vinegar, Epsom salt, and dish soap.
Or Coca-Cola. I've heard people say Coke, too.
That's a, wow.
Ugh. Yep.
But, and what that, I mean, does it work? You know, and I guess I would like, I have my own answer, but I'd like to hear somebody else's opinion of it.
Definitely doesn't work as good as a hoe.
There we go. Mechanical uses. A hoe. That, yeah, a shovel and a hoe will get you a really long ways, for sure.
Well, my understanding of that specific example you gave, Matt, is that it's kind of acts as a burn down herbicide. So if you're dealing with annuals that don't have a perennial root system and it's early in their growth, that may work, right? You burn them down and they don't come back. It's more challenging with species that have perennial root system, like Canada thistle, field bindweed, leafy spurge, those species that we know have these extensive root systems, that those types of herbicides don't get
systemic
into the root system.
They go up and down.
I guess, would add, as far as I know, the vinegar you need to use to control weeds is not just your household vinegar.
I think it needs to be above 50% or 40%.
I don't know. There's some organic herbicide formulations that tend to be a mixture of some sort of clove oil or
vinegar
together. Some countries of the world, they sell cleaning vinegar at the supermarket, and that's 10% acidity versus what I drink in my salad dressing is 5% acidity. So I think, yeah, those higher acidity, you get better burned out. You have more acetic acid.
You drink your salad dressing?
Oh, occasionally. I really, okay. You know, good balsamic vinaigrette, just a little sip of it, delicious.
All right. You're giving me so much entertainment today, Tim. I can't even begin to tell you. The other thing to remember, vinegar is non-selective. As Jane said, it's burn down. So if you go out there in your lawn thinking, or your garden, you can easily cause some pretty massive collateral damage because wherever those droplets touch plant tissue, that plant tissue is going to be killed. And, you know, when you get up into those higher acidities too, it can burn you just as much.
And it may affect your soil chemistry a little bit. I'm not sure. But in the garden, if I'm standing around, by the time I mix up my vinegar and would get ready
you
to spray,
pulled it out.
I can get my stirrup hoe and head through the garden, and it's pretty cool.
And I rarely have I experienced where putting Epsom salt down on the ground has been beneficial to the plants that are there. So there's some long-lasting stuff there. But
beneficial to bare ground.
Beneficial to bare ground. Driveways? Go for it. Lawn and garden? Maybe rethink that plan. Ben, you got a favorite way of controlling weeds without chemical?
I would say lately what's been really interesting is biologicals, that I've been doing a little more work with biological control. Toad flax, Dalmatian toad flax, I've seen really good success.
I have some you can practice on.
I've collected some in this very county and distributed it, yes. And so I've seen good success on toad flax, spotted knapweed, leafy spurge, hound's tongue, the... What is that thing called?
Mugolonis. Yeah. The weevil.
The weevil. That's not... we don't want to go there. You can cut this out.
No, it's fine.
That's a subtopic for another podcast.
Once again, scientific name that you just magically know.
I knew the crucifer part because it has a cross, white cross on its back is how you identify it. But it looks to be like it's naturally in Montana. It hasn't been approved for use as a biocontrol agent yet, but it's interesting that it's very effective on houndstone control. And the Canada thistle rust, that looks really, really interesting. I don't know, that's just an area of non-chemical control that has been pretty interesting to me lately.
Tim?
I think mine's going to be, we're working on this Canada thistle rust as part of an organic project. And it will be interesting to see. We have a lot where we're setting up some experiments to really measure what impact it does have on Canada thistle. It's out there. We find it in the state. You'll be hearing more from us about that. I think the jury's out on how well it works. We're trying to implement it in cropping systems, which could be a little bit more difficult. But yeah, I think integrating some of these mowing, biological controls, different crop rotations, I think, yeah, those are the things that I'm interested in, without letting all our soil blow away.
Sure. And yeah, that's definitely the ledge that we gotta kind of tiptoe on is when we start to reincorporate tillage into the system. Because we've worked very hard to, you know, really reduce our tillage impact in our crop fields. And something that I think is to be proud of, but for sure, it's still a tool that we may eventually have to use again. Right now, fire. I am big on using fire for weeds. I don't know why. If you're in town or if you've got a garden thing or something like that and you are against shovels and chemicals, propane torch will do the trick. Shane mentioned perennials, and it's always important to remember that no matter what, perennials are going to be harder to kill. The cool thing that made me think about this, it's a burner for alfalfa fields. And it was originally designed for weevil control, to run your burner over the field. You're driving pretty fast. You're actually not putting a lot of heat out. But alfalfa being a perennial, the way it is, can handle that heat. Fries out the weevils, but it also has an impact on any annual weeds you have in the field too. So I've always been a fan of fire.
I'll add one more that's a little out there, but it's showing up more and more, is electricity, actually, electroshocking. So in California and other places, they're actually driving along with mesh nets that have high voltage, and it'll actually zap the weeds, and there is some success out there. Actually, putting a mesh net over Canada thistle patches is another thing that people have been thinking about. Putting a solar panel, a battery on there, and just shocking that Canada thistle every time it hits the net.
Interesting.
Yep.
I
thinking outside the box.
Well, there's a lot of that going on because, I mean, there's been some research into lasers. Controlling weeds with lasers, of course, There's always the big one with the drones, the weed seekers, all that kind of stuff. But outside of chemicals, there's actually a lot of wild stuff that happens in the world.
Yeah, Australia, they have, believe it or not, much more herbicide-resistant problems than we do. And some of the other things are in, they have a weed chipper that basically has a chisel point on it and a camera that sits on the front of the tractor, and the chisel just comes down and hits and, like, pocks the weed out of a little hole each time. And so you're not incorporating tillage in the whole field. You're just kind of popping out the weeds as they go along. So that's one other method that some of the Australians have been working on. Harvest weed seeds, so collecting the chaff off
and using the impact hammer.
Yeah, using the impact hammer. That's going to be difficult. Monty and I don't hold out too much hope for it, but it's interesting because our cheatgrass seems to dehiss and break apart and fall off from the plant before we're ready to harvest our grain.
I also don't see a lot of people putting forward the kind of cash for one of those pieces of machinery.
Yeah, we'll see what the price of tech, you know, it always starts expensive, and we'll see where the price of that technology is.
I think they were doing some research on that in Kansas.
Yep. A former colleague, Judy Barroso in Oregon, she's done it with cheatgrass in eastern Oregon, similar climate to what we have. Limited success because of the weeds are breaking apart before
they can get out the chaff.
Yeah.
Matt, I'd like to say something about busting myths.
Jane.
And you may or may not want to use this.
I would love to.
Podcast. I think one of the most difficult situations for us to deal with in extension, as far as busting a myth, is when a new tool or a new product comes along that is sometimes marketed as being a silver bullet for a weed, but there's not necessarily any research or field-based data to back it up. That's a challenging situation to be in, because you, as the extension professional, are curious about whether it works or not, but you can't really make a recommendation to use it because there's no science to back up that it's effective. So I think that can be a challenging situation that we're sometimes in when it comes to when people call us and ask us, hey, what about this, and does it work, and should I use it, or how do I use it? And you don't really know what to say.
You don't want to say no.
You don't want to say no, but you also can't really say we have evidence that it works.
Yeah. And that's, I think that, I mean, that's certainly not just us as weed professionals. I mean, that's through the entire pest world. I mean, there's something every other day for, you know, controlling rodents, controlling insects, controlling whatever you want, you know, safe to use kind of thing. That's what they like to throw in front of it, too. Safe to use at home.
Yeah, and sometimes those questions will actually prompt us to do the research to answer the question. I mean, a great example recently is with the Pseudomonas fluorescens that was being developed commercially for controlling cheatgrass without any field data to show it worked. And a group of us across the West, in, you know, multiple states, were able to put field studies in to test that organism in replicated field studies to get the data to actually show it. Well, it doesn't look very promising, at least in for cheatgrass and rangeland in the settings that we're trying in.
For sure.
I just don't think there's ever going to be a silver bullet, because you're always going to have some kind of, either it doesn't work as well as it's touted, or there's other negative trade-offs.
Well, and we're always dealing with nature, right? And what is nature best at but adaptability? And so survival of the fittest certainly is the rule of the day. And, you know, we'll beat it. We might be able to beat it today, but there's no guarantee that we'll be able to beat it tomorrow. And so always looking at different ways and always looking at multiple paths, I think, is exceptionally important. Just to wrap up, last thoughts. Jane, we'll start with you. Any last thoughts?
I just shared all the thoughts I have. That's it.
Okay. No. That's
well,
fair.
I would just say thanks, Matt, for having this podcast and for talking about the subject of weed management, it's certainly not a glamorous subject, but it's something that everybody deals with, whether you're dealing with a small lawn in town, a crop field in the Golden Triangle, or, you know, Forest Service or BLM land, you know, thousands and thousands of acres. So thanks for having us. And
thank you for being here, James. Benjamin?
Yeah, thank you for having us, Matt. It was, I really enjoyed it. I think weed management is one thing that concerns everybody in the state of Montana, whether you just rent a house that happens to have a lawn or you own a lot of acreage. So it's something that everybody throughout the state worries about to some extent. So it's a really good, important subject to talk about, and there's a lot of different layers, and it's like we talked about a lot of different things today. They're very complex, and so it's good to get the education.
Tim?
Yeah, thanks for having us. I love talking about this stuff and from all aspects, and I think it's always important to understand the biology. It's always important to understand how organisms interact. And that's how we develop long-term sustainable solutions for managing weeds, is really understanding all the biology and the ecology together.
Outstanding. Thank you all for being here. I'm greatly appreciative. Thank you for making the trek to Helena. It was great to have you. And so everybody at home knows, yeah, we did social distance. We're 6 feet apart. We're safe. We're healthy. You stay safe and healthy, and we will see you on the next episode.
What happens if I die without a will?
Where can I get my soil tested?
How can I grow organic food to sell at the farmer's market?
My kids want to join 4-H. Where do we sign up?
How can we keep our Main Street businesses strong?
You can get all the answers you need in one place, your local MSU Extension office. Visit them on the web at msuextension.org to locate the office nearest you. And to download free resources, visit msuextension.org.